Okay, well, this is one of the most fundamental arguments, I think, for Marxists, you know, that we talk about the central role of the working class in changing the world and changing it fundamentally. So it's absolutely vital that we understand what is going on with the working class. And in particular, that we're able to deal with the arguments of people who are not Marxists, who want to argue that this Marxist stuff about the working class as the central force for changing the world is somehow out of date. So talking about the structure of the working class today, obviously pretty key issue for us. I want to go back to Marx to begin with, because Marx made this argument that that capitalism itself creates a force that can potentially oppose it and overthrow it, and that force is the working class. In Marx's somewhat more poetic words, capitalism creates its own grave diggers. And there's a few, I think, things to go through just to sort of flesh out that basic argument, that we begin with exploitation, that capitalism's basic motivating force is the seizure of people's labour, that the surplus value that Marx talks about, that concentration and centralisation of the capital that the capitalists accumulate takes place because of the competition between them, and this means the creation of massive workplaces in massive industrial cities. Thirdly, when workers fight against the system, they're forced to fight in a collective manner. Of course, this doesn't mean that workers can't be individualistic, that they can't have kind of atomised ideas and so on. Lots of the time they do. They cannot fight against the system. It's not compulsory. But when workers want to fight to improve their own conditions, they have to fight collectively. And this way they're different from the oppressed classes of previous class societies. And finally, because capitalism is based upon competition between rival capitals, each of them has all the time to squeeze more out of the workers under their command. And this means that the capitalist class needs not just any old people to exploit, it also needs a working class that increasingly has more culture, more education, more skills than any oppressed class previously in history. And so at the heart of capitalism is a force that has the potential, I'll stress that word, potential, to fight the system. Because as I said, none of this is inevitable, automatic or anything like it. So that's kind of a very brief overview of the arguments that Marx made about the centrality of the working class and why the working class had that potential to overthrow capitalism. But there is obviously a debate about this. Against Marx's argument, particularly whenever there have been periods of defeat for working class struggle, when workers' organisations have fragmented, when workers have turned against each other, then you get the opening for an idea that really this stuff about the working class, look at them, they're so atomised, they're so backward, look at they're divided by all of these divisive ideas. Then in that situation, perhaps all that Marxist stuff about the central role of the working class is no longer relevant. And so the working class is no longer central in this argument, and there's some other agency that we can turn to if we want to fundamentally change the world that capitalism has thrown up. I think if you look at the last three decades, for example, there's been a shift by some formerly radical theorists away from seeing the struggle between capital and labour as central to social change. And sometimes the names of the books, I think, give it all away. If you go back to the 1980s, the French theorist André Gortz, his book was called Farewell to the Working Class. Any of you who have suffered under postmodernism as a way of looking at the world in your university courses, for example, will hopefully have developed a certain hostility and suspicion of the prefix post to anything. And certainly in the 1980s and into the 1990s, other posts are allied in many ways with postmodernism. The idea of post-industrialism or post-Fordism, another variant of the idea, well, all that old working class stuff, you know, basically we don't have those dark satanic mills anymore. We don't have the exploited blue-collar, you know, stereotype male manual, etc., wearing overalls worker. These people are disappearing, and after all, that's the only workers that Marx was interested in anyway. Or there is, I think, other variants of this idea, that the authors of a book that came out in 1996, again, the title itself, I think, indicative. The book was called not Farewell to the Working Class, but The Death of Class, more definitive. And the authors of The Death of Class argued that whatever the objective class situation of workers, other differences, identities and so on, were more important in determining their interests and actions. The idea of the working class as a collective actor able to make a difference to the way the world was, that was a thing of the past. I think today, in the 21st century, we can see some similar arguments put forward, I think most centrally by Michael Hart and Tony Negri, initially in their book Empire, but there's been, I think, now a third has just come out, a book in the series, making sort of similar arguments. One of the central arguments, coming back to Empire, is the idea that we can no longer look to the working class as an agency of change, and in fact that the working class is beginning to disappear, that workers are no longer concentrated together in large workplaces, that all of the things that have historically characterised working class identity and living conditions and lifestyle, if you like, that these things are really very much on the decline, in the process of disappearing. And I'll just quote their central argument, I think, summed up in this quote. In a previous era, the category of the proletariat centred on and at times was effectively subsumed under the industrial working class. Today, that working class has all but disappeared from view. It has not ceased to exist, but it has been displaced from its central position in the capitalist economy. And instead, everyone under capitalism is seen as part of the system, obviously not the capitalists, but everyone else is seen as part of the system, and therefore everyone under capitalism can be equally central to the struggle against it. And the term that they've used for this is the multitude, not the working class, but the multitude. Now, there's obviously an element of truth in this. There's all kinds of movements that break out in the world today. And the crisis of capitalism creates all sorts of pressures for revolts and rebellions. But what's not true is that all of these are collective struggles, or that they are, more importantly, that they are all equally effective. The notion of the multitude that Hart and Negri put across really, I think, implies that any struggle anywhere has potentially the same weight and the same importance. And this is buttressed by the idea very much of the disappearing working class. So the immediate question, I think, that we have to address is there any evidence for this? And here I make no apologies for relying very much on the work of Chris Harman, the late British Marxist Chris Harman. His book, his article, The Workers of the World, is, again, just a really comprehensive survey of what evidence do we have for this. Can we just assert these things, or do we actually need to provide some evidence? And worldwide, obviously, there have been changes in capitalism over the last few decades, the last quarter of a century. But this is nothing new. I mean, the whole history of capitalism has been a history of change, new areas of production growing, old areas disappearing. And so, for example, you look at the structure of the Australian working class, for example, go back to the 19th century. How much of the workforce were involved in agriculture, pastoral industry and so on? How much of the Australian workforce is engaged in this today? Less than 5%. But has Australian capitalism disappeared? Has the Australian working class disappeared? Well, it's a question that I hope to answer in the course of this talk. I'm not going to be just talking about Australia, by the way. I will be talking about trying to look at the world working class, because obviously the argument stands or falls not on what happens in relatively unimportant Australia, but the working class as an international class. So new areas of production have been growing, old areas disappearing, and this is a process as old as capitalism. But of course it's not the same as the working class disappearing. In fact, if we understand class as being constituted not by occupational categories, but by relations of production, then the picture, I think, is very different. So I'm going to start with the developed world. And one of the arguments that gets made here is that this is particularly the place where we see the disappearance of the traditional working class, the working class as stereotypically understood as manufacturing workers, miners, and so on. And Harman gives some very useful figures, I think, in particular in relation to the United States. His argument is that this is not a class that is disappearing. At the end of the 1970s, there was a panic in the United States with people talking about deindustrialisation. Again, these ideas are not, you know, new to the 21st century. In the 1970s, deindustrialisation, all the manufacturing and mining jobs in the United States are all disappearing, the Rust Belt is beginning, close down of all this kind of industry and so on. But in 1998, the number of people working in industry in the United States was 20% higher than it had been in 1974, roughly speaking. It was 50% higher than it had been in 1950, and it was four times the level it had been in 1900. Now, we're talking here absolute numbers. We're not talking the proportion of the workforce, but in terms of the argument, is this section of the working class disappearing? The absolute numbers, I think, have considerable weight. And so there was continual growth in the number of workers in those old-style industries of mining, manufacturing, and so forth. The absolute size, in other words, of the traditional industrial working class in the United States continued to grow right up until the beginning of the recession of 2000. This is not uniformly the case in the developed economies. In some European countries, the picture is somewhat different. The number of workers in manufacturing industry in Britain, for example, actually has halved over the recession since the 1970s. The numbers have gone down. The number of people in manufacturing jobs in France has fallen by about a third, in Italy by about 20%. But the point that Harman goes on to make is a fall of 20% is not a disappearance of the category, and there is continual growth of the number of people in traditional industries worldwide. And I'll come to look at the developing world slightly later. Alongside what's happened to this particular category of the working class has gone the vast expansion in the number of people in paid employment overall, which raises a second question about the working class, which is the growth of services. Sometimes the argument about the disappearance of the working class is very much focused on the disappearance, which hopefully those figures have dispelled anyway, of traditional industrial workers. However, we've got to look elsewhere in terms of if capitalism is reconstituting itself, changing its organisation and so on, we should expect that the occupational structure of the working class will also change. And so I want to go on to argue that the growth of service sector work is in fact a growth of the working class. I think some of the confusion perhaps arises out of this because people confuse the categories of industry and services with the categories of manual work and white collar work. But this is nonsense. You think about it historically. Service sector work has always included very large numbers of manual workers. You think about wharfies. They're service sector workers. They're obviously in that kind of stereotypical manual blue-collar kind of category. Bus and train drivers, garbos. There's a whole series of service sector jobs, ones that, you know, traditional service sector jobs that are very much in the manual worker category. Hart and Negri make a great deal of the growth of what they call service employment, but they also give the impression that service employment is basically all what they call informational employment, employment to do with the processing of information, what other writers have called knowledge workers. And again, the argument tends to flow that this kind of work has no location in the centre of capitalism, that these people are in somehow, well, there's a variety of arguments that these people are somehow bought off, or that they have no social power because they're just involved in these intangibles of knowledge or information. Let's try and look more deeply at the actual service sector working class. In 2003 in the United States, there were 103 million people included in service employment. And it's certainly not the case that all of these were some kind of informational or knowledge workers, some kind of skilled professionals or anything like it. There are 18 million people in that 103 million in what are obviously manual occupations. Janitors, security personnel, food services, cleaners, the people who stack the shelves in the supermarkets and so on. There are another 18 million in routine clerical jobs. There are another 6.75 million sales assistants, people working on checkouts at shops and so on. And in other words, the service sector white collar workers, if we can call them white collar, which I think is a pretty debatable term in itself, that these workers, vast groups of them, have jobs as routine, as boring, as tiring, and as devastating to their lives as much of traditional manual work. And there are something like, Harman calculates, 42 million people altogether in such jobs in the United States. And so far from the working class disappearing, if we're looking at the figures for the United States overall, you still come to a figure that indicates that the majority of the population of the United States are still workers. There's an excellent book by an American academic called Michael Zweig. And Michael Zweig's book, again, the titles are indicative. His book has a lovely title. It's called The Working Class Majority, America's Best Kept Secret. Okay, so I want to say a little bit about Australia, saying we should sort of see if this fits in what's happening here as well. And again, I think we can say pretty clearly the industrial and occupational characteristics of Australia's working class have changed substantially, not just in the long history of white Australia, but more substantially over recent decades. And this is, again, not a particularly new process. Large companies have replaced family firms, the public service has expanded at various times, new sectors of employment have emerged. So things like purchasing, marketing, accounting and administration have expanded to employ virtually an army of white-collar workers. In 2003, a little over 65% of the Australian workforce was employed as service employees, salespersons, insurance clerks, bank tellers, teachers, nurses, social workers, technical officers as a whole, the list goes on. At the same time, traditional so-called working class jobs, the narrowly defined industrial kind of jobs, or, you know, again including service sector jobs like drivers, plant machine operator, labourer, tradesperson, these occupations made up over half the labour force in 1947 in Australia. They're now less than a third. And in Australia, again, we've seen the decline of the percentage of the workforce employed in manufacturing. In 1966, this was over a quarter of employment. By 2002, it had fallen to 12%. And the figures haven't changed particularly since then. So a word of warning though, of course, I've given these occupational categories used from how the Australian Bureau of Statistics divides occupations up. But of course, the Australian Bureau of Statistics aren't Marxist and they don't have an approach to try and work out what class these people are all in. So there's obviously something to take into account that doesn't mean that all these service sector or white collar employees are in the working class. Obviously, in the Australian Bureau of Statistics categorisation, they include salaried members of the capitalist class. You know, they're apparently workers, wage earners anyway. So their just wages are somewhat different to the rest of ours. So salaried members of the bourgeoisie, people in contradictory class locations, a sort of new middle class of supervisors, people who have some degree of control over the labour of others, but the vast majority are, of course, themselves workers. They don't own or control the means of production, they don't control their own labour and they don't control the labour of others. They're just in there being exploited day in and day out in a way that is entirely analogous or the same as the worker in the traditional manufacturing or mining sector. Okay, so, and there's a few things. I think some of the issues that you can see in the way I mentioned about the growth of service sector work that can be just as dehumanising, mind-numbing and so on as a tailorist. You know, what's the difference between working on a tailorist assembly line, putting food into cans in a manufacturing factory setup, to making food on an assembly line at McDonald's? One seemed to be manufacturing, working class, proletarian, the other service, knowledge worker, whatever. Nonsense. The similarities are what count. And so, in fact, the employer strategy of simplifying, routinising and fragmenting jobs in order to exercise more control over their workers has actually led to, it's the reason for the convergence in the nature and conditions of all kinds of working class activities. Because the bosses, they have to bring together workers from different backgrounds into the cities, into large-scale industry, and so capital itself imposes a common lifestyle and work discipline on the bulk of the population, on the working class. And so the work experience itself, whether it's on an assembly line or as a member of a team in a public service office, organises workers and teaches them cooperation. Of course, it's that organisation and cooperation that underlies some of the dangers for the capitalist class of creating this category of people. Okay, there's one other claim that gets made before we leave the developed world that gets made about this, what's happening to the structure of the working class. And that's the claim that all of these jobs are insecure. Hart and Negri, for example, say that these are all of these new jobs are jobs that could disappear overnight. And it's true that there has been, over the last 20 or 30 years, in the developed world, an increase in non-permanent, non-full-time employment. Sometimes it's called precarious or insecure employment, but I think that label covers over a range of differences. There's a question also that arises, which is, even if there are lots more casual workers than there used to be, does this automatically follow that casuals can't be organised, that casuals don't have any social power, and so on? We'll leave that question for now. Let's just have a look at, again, some of the facts and figures. I'll go back to Australian ones. Since the mid-60s in Australia, there's been a boom in part-time employment, and it's primarily involved women. Much of this pattern arose because a large proportion of women who wanted to join the paid workforce, who needed to join the paid workforce, have been restricted to part-time hours, not because they loved working part-time and couldn't hack full-time work, but because childcare is inadequate or just totally unavailable. In fact, it's worth mentioning in passing here that worldwide women are being drawn into paid labour in increasing numbers, but of course this hasn't meant that they no longer have to carry the burden of childcare and so on, that the two things, capital expects to get both the double burden of women of the exploitation as workers in paid labour and the expectation that they will do the work of bringing up the next generation of the working class for capital and do it for love and not for money, that hasn't gone away. But the contradictory nature of capitalism is that by drawing them into wage labour, it makes women even more open to forms of collective organisation than ever before. The other thing to say about the shift between full-time and part-time work, between permanent and casual and so on, and part-time and casual are not the same thing. You can be full-time and casual and you can be permanent and part-time. But full-time work itself has changed. About 15% of full-time jobs are now casual or fixed term rather than permanent in Australia. And the Australian workforce is today divided fairly evenly between permanent employees and those in non-standard employment. Between 1985 and 2001 in Australia, the labour force grew by 2.5 million jobs, but within that expansion there were job losses, and the jobs that were lost were disproportionately full-time jobs. The growth areas, on the other hand, have been industries characterised by high level of part-time and or insecure work, things like hospitality and so on. And this has led to a net loss of employment across the economy, and it's reflected in both unemployment levels and more particularly an underemployment level. And I think this process is one that's been really exacerbated by the current economic crisis. But it's also true that everywhere that capitalism exploits labour, it wants some degree of commitment from the workforce. It wants some degree of stability in the workforce. So the idea that you're going to find every employer just having no permanent workforce at all, just employing a whole army of random atomised casuals and so on. Actually, this is not in the capitalist interest. The idea that you can get rid of all of the full-time permanent workers and so on and go totally to, you know, they love flexibility, but not that much. I think another way of looking at it, it's again, something I think Chris Harman's always been really excellent at is turning figures on their head. And he gives in his article, for example, that in Europe as a whole, this is in 2003, 18% of jobs were insecure jobs. And this was quite a growth. I mean, Australia's always had more of this stuff than, say, Europe has. But 18% of insecure jobs, big shift in Europe. But, of course, he makes the obvious point. That means 82% of them aren't. And I think that's worth keeping in mind when we look at these figures of things are shifting in a certain direction, but it's not a question of disappearance. We have to acknowledge that there is insecurity and the attempt to create insecurity amongst workers, but at the same time there is also a workforce that still has the capacity to fight back. I want to move on briefly to just say a little bit about the situation in the rest of the world. World Bank figures, unfortunately now somewhat out of date, really from the 1990s, show at that point about a third of the people in the what used to be called the third world, the non-OECD, developing countries, whatever, about a third of the people in that part of the world economy were in paid employment, and about half were still involved in self-employment on the land. But if you analyse the categories further, the working class component shifts, becomes bigger. You find that in most third world countries today, about half the people working on the land for themselves are to some extent also dependent on wage labour. You think about, I think that China is the obvious example to be thinking about in terms of looking at these kind of figures. You've got a massive expansion of the workforce in the city, and we'll come back to exactly how that workforce is broken up, what they're doing and so on. But there's also still a degree of fluidity, of back and forth, of people who are still living in the countryside part of the year, but who supplement the meagre income that they can make from basically from rural agriculture by doing work in the towns and so on in addition to it. So Harman argues that, based on these World Bank figures, that about half the people working the land for themselves are in some ways also dependent on wage labour. So about a third of the world's workforce are involved in classic capitalist relations of production, depending mainly, in other words, on wage labour to survive. About a third remain self-employed, mainly peasants in the countryside, and there's a third who spend part of their time working for capital, part of the time working for themselves. And this process is an ongoing one. None of this is static. And there are two simultaneous processes which are changing this picture over time. The first is the massive urbanisation of the world. Comrades probably noticed, I think it was last year, there was a little item in the news that the magic figure had been passed, that half of the world's population last year now live in cities. But give a bit of context to that. In 1975, 37% of the world's population lived in towns or cities. In 1995, 45% lived in towns, and last year, for the first time, half the population of the world were urban. And the prediction is that even in the third world, this process will mean that by 2015, half of the population of the third world will be dwellers in cities or towns. Within that, there is a trend where people who used to work the land are forced to seek work in large cities, but this doesn't mean that there's an automatic growth of the permanent workforce. In most parts of the world, this process has not meant people leave the land, come into the cities and get full-time jobs. It's much more like what the Industrial Revolution in Britain was like in the 18th century. This process generally has produced a small growth in the permanent workforce and alongside it a massive growth of a transitory workforce of people who either live by the most meagre forms of self-employment, that who sell matches, shoelaces, who drive taxis, who sometimes sell their own bodies, those sorts of things, alongside people who try to sell their labour on a casual basis. So they're involved in wage labour, but their attachment to it is much more tenuous. But with the exception of parts of Africa, it's an important exception, the employed section of the workforce is not disappearing. It's growing larger, and I think the areas to look at here are Brazil, Russia, India and China. In those areas, this process is going, you know, has gone the furthest, I think, and the numbers are the largest. In each case, there's an interaction between the growth of the casual workforce and the growth of the permanent workforce. The permanent workforce is growing much more slowly out of this process of urbanisation in many of these countries, but the permanent workforce is growing alongside a much greater growth of the casual and insecure. Okay, finally, how are we going for time?
Pretty good. Good.
Okay, I just want to say a little bit to sum up about why does this argument matter. And again, I'll go back to Harman. I think he sums it up really concisely. He says, workers who are concentrated together in large workplaces under the thumb of managers, subject to timekeeping, subject to the pressures continually to be disciplined by the system, at the same time have the potential when they struggle to shake the system, but not only to shake the system. They have the potential to organise themselves because they are concentrated together. The culture capitalism forces on them creates the potential for becoming a force that can not only shake but change the system. And so we come up back to this question of why the working class is central. Firstly, remind ourselves that the whole history of revolts by peasants or by the urban poor who are not in workplaces is that they can explode onto the streets and then they can be driven back into their shanties or their farms and the revolt collapses. The history of the workers' struggle is that when workers struggle and gain victories, they can create collective organisations that persist over time and they begin to create the possibility to struggle against the system as a whole. The second thing that we have to say about this notion of the multitude of all struggles equally anti-capitalist, equally capable of dragging down the system, and I will say to their credit that Hart and Negri do want to drag down the system, they just, I think, don't identify the forces that's actually capable of doing it. So the second thing we have to say about the notion of multitude is that not all multitudes are progressive. And again, I'll use an example that Harman uses because, to be honest, to my great shame, this strike had entirely passed me by. I was alive during it, well alive, you know, old even, and it had passed me by, so I want to introduce it to you, comrades. In 1983, a massive textile strike shook Bombay. It was probably Mumbai now, isn't it?
Mm.
Yeah. It was probably the biggest strike the world has ever known. It lasted for 12 months with 1 million workers on strike. For that period, collective ideas dominated the mass of poor people in and out of jobs in the Mumbai area. That strike was defeated. In the aftermath of it, what came to dominate in Mumbai, rooted among the poor, the self-employed and so forth, was what one might call a fascist organisation called the Shiv Sena, which directed the hatred of the middle castes against the lowest, the Dalits, the untouchables, the hatred of Hindus against Muslims. In the same city, the same multitude of people subjugated to capital, their lives being ruined by the system, could turn in two directions. One to collective struggle, as the strike showed, one to individualistic struggle. The collective struggle is beaten, the individualistic struggle comes to the fore. And he goes on to say, if you talk about multitude, either you've got the progressive multitude, whose position, rooted in the system, drives it forward to challenge the system, or you can have the reactionary multitude. And I think there's a somewhat less depressing examples of, again, the question of that looking to struggle, and we do look to struggle, we celebrate struggle as it breaks out, any struggle that takes on some aspect of the system. Obviously, we support these struggles, we are in solidarity with them and so on, but we also don't have an uncritical attitude to all struggles. I think another example closer to home for most of us is to think about that massive day of worldwide protests on the streets around, well, it was kind of a weekend of it, around the 15th of February 2003, before the outbreak of America's attack on Iraq, 20th of March 2003, a month before it, millions of people, over 10 million people, simultaneously demonstrating around the world, out on the streets. But it didn't stop the war, did it? And the important thing there is not to say, oh, well, we shouldn't have demonstrated. It's to see, well, where's the weak link on our side? And the weak link is what stops capital, is those that create the value it's exploiting actually use that power to stop them in their tracks. That's the weak link as far as capital is concerned. Capital can't exist without workers. It can murder the unemployed. It can increasingly find the peasantry marginal. But the system itself cannot live for a second without the working class. So it's not enough to just say, we're a multitude, it's fantastic, look, there's great struggles. Often that is what we want to say, it's the beginning of wisdom. But you also have to say, what are the issues facing the mass of people and where do those masses have the power to actually make real change? So I want to conclude on a more hopefully optimistic note. Any time in the 20th century when workers, manual, blue collar, white collar, service sector or whatever, when workers moved together collectively, they shook governments, they reshaped society, they stopped wars. When they were beaten back, it wasn't only workers who suffered. Every other group that wanted to emancipate itself suffered, and every other group fighting oppression also suffered. Because the working class is not just passively shaped by the forces of production and the capitalist class. As workers are responsible for the production of society's wealth, they also possess the ability to create a wholly different social organisation, the organisation that we are always looking for, wishing for, organising for, trying to bend our every effort towards, that is, a society, a a form of different social organisation based on human need rather than on the dictates of profitability.